From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. Our topic on this edition of the program, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken visits Saudi Arabia and meets with the Gulf Cooperation Council to discuss security and economic issues, even as China wields ever more influence in a region once dominated by the United States. Our guest, Catherine Zimmerman, a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, that's a distinguished think tank here in Washington, a frequent and valued analyst at these microphones. Catherine focuses on the global Salafi jihadi movement and counterterrorism. She also studies the Al-Qaeda network and related trends in the Middle East and Africa. Catherine Zimmerman is also an advisor to AEI's Critical Threats Project and has testified before Congress about the threats to U.S. national security interests emanating from Al-Qaeda and its network. This week, we are delighted to welcome her back to discuss the many issues on Secretary Blinken's agenda, including but not limited to ending the conflict in Yemen, reaching a ceasefire and long-term solution to the outbreak of violence in Sudan, continuing to combat the Islamic State group, and promoting normalization between Israel and Saudi Arabia in the context of the Abraham Accords. Catherine Zimmerman joins us via Microsoft Teams. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to return, Carol.
Catherine, let's start with the U.S.-Saudi relationship, the timing and the purpose of this trip by Antony Blinken, which was preceded just a month ago by National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. What does the United States hope to achieve with Saudi Arabia in particular, which we note has been reaching out to China and even Russia, suggesting that relations with the U.S., or at least with the Biden administration, are not as robust as Washington would like?
The relationship with Saudi Arabia currently is certainly not as robust as Washington would like, but it's still there and there are many shared interests. And this is something when you visit Saudi Arabia, you hear from Saudi officials that over the decades that Saudi Arabia and the United States have been very closely allied or a little bit more distance. And I think we're at a point in time where there's a little bit more distance between their interests. Particularly today, what's critical to see is that the United States really does need to work with and through Saudi Arabia to achieve some of its objectives in the region. And part of that is because we have moved resources out of the region, but some of that is also because Saudi Arabia itself is taking unilateral steps, mobilizing the Gulf states and other Arab states behind it that set realities that inform the space in which the United States can act.
And of course, the administration wants to underscore the fact that they are not leaving the Middle East, that yes, they can pivot to East Asia and work on shoring up Ukraine. But nonetheless, that is the perception. And speaking of other powers, as you know, Catherine, China recently brokered that rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and its arch rival, Iran. Help us revisit the impetus for that move.
Just for clarity, this rapprochement is actually quite limited in its steps. Saudi Arabia and Iran broke diplomatic ties in 2017, and that was the closure of their embassies as there was growing conflict between the two states. And that conflict was over Yemen, over Iran's expeditionary behavior in places like Iraq and Syria, and the idea that Iran was growing in influence. What was brokered is actually still somewhat unclear between the two states, but we do see the resumption of diplomatic correspondence and relations, and a statement by Saudi Arabia that struck me as quite interesting, that they're looking at setting this as a new tone for the region going forward with Iran. The context of this, of course, is that Iran is growing in power. The question of whether it will get a nuclear bomb is not a question of if, but when. And that really changes the security and the strategic considerations of Saudi Arabia. It's informed decisions within the kingdom, how other Gulf states are posturing as well, and fundamentally how Saudi Arabia has to engage with Iran and ensure its own security. Now, The China role in this is fascinating because, of course, it is sticking it to the United States. The U.S. had been encouraging an effort in Baghdad that was bringing together the Saudis and the Iranians to negotiate this precise deal. So the fact that it went through a Chinese mediation to come to fruition really stung for the United States and was a blow, again, to the relationship between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia.
So there are embassies in both countries between Saudi Arabia and Iran, right? And what else can we say about this relationship? Is it bearing any fruit with regard to, say, in Yemen?
There are embassies in both countries. They have, I believe, re-exchanged ambassadors. And the key hope, at least from the American side, that this leads to progress in Yemen. As we know well, we have the Saudis engaged in conflict in Yemen on the side of the internationally recognized Yemeni government. And then against them are the Houthis, who have received extensive Iranian support. And the concept is that with the Saudi-Iranian rapprochement, that the proxy war that has been ongoing inside of Yemen through the Houthis will be put on the back burner in order to reach some sort of negotiated political settlement in that country. It's quite true that the Saudis are seeking peace in Yemen, but the challenge really is that the Iranians don't fully control the Houthis, and that they have continued to flow weapons that threaten both Saudi and regional security into Yemen, even after there have been progress diplomatically with talks between the Saudis and the Houthis. So I think there's a lot of hope riding on this relationship that is misplaced and misreading the influence of the Saudi-Iranian relationship and that relationship to the Yemeni civil war and the conflict that is ongoing in the country.
Just following up on that, since it is a topic for discussions, how much of a priority do you think this is, notwithstanding what you just said, that the rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia certainly doesn't hurt, but it may not really help it along because there's so many other dynamics in the country. And you follow this conflict so closely, Catherine, and it's just heartbreaking, a terrible humanitarian disaster. What other parties do you see getting involved in pushing this to a peaceful conclusion? What else can you add?
The key party that has been fundamentally left out of these talks has been the Yemeni government itself. And yes, the Yemeni government is somewhat dependent upon the Saudis, and they certainly have influence over some of its decisions and many of its resources. But it does raise the question of how much the Yemenis themselves are bought into this and how much this is a Houthi-Saudi deal rather than a resolution to the conflict that is ongoing inside of Yemen. There are indications that there are conversations ongoing with the president of Yemen's Presidential Leadership Council, who fundamentally is the sovereign inside of Yemen today. Secretary Blinken did meet with him on the sidelines of his visit to Saudi Arabia. Their conversation was certainly about the requirements for a negotiated settlement, what the Yemeni government would need, but also what it would need to accept, according to the United States and Saudi Arabia. The bigger challenge, however, is if you read anything about the Yemeni government today in its opposition to the Houthis, it remains united. But on so many other crucial factors, it is fundamentally divided. And so the pessimism that certain Yemen analysts have about the ability of even a Saudi-Houthi deal, which could be in the works. We had unprecedented direct talks between the two. We have pictures now of Saudi diplomats in Sana'a, the capital of Yemen, with Houthi negotiators. It's the question of whether that actually ends the war. And for many, this is just one more step in a very complicated conflict and not actually the beginning of the end of it.
Catherine, what can you tell us about the humanitarian situation inside Yemen? I think the Yemen conflict is overshadowed to some extent by Sudan, by the invasion of Ukraine, by Russia, but it's still there. And I'd like you to give us a sense of the humanitarian situation facing the country and the people.
The humanitarian situation is horrible inside of Yemen. It's not at its worst, but that doesn't mean that it is good. And the challenges that Yemenis who don't have food, don't have clean water, don't have access to basic medicine or even schooling face is that they are now one of many in a long list of other countries that require humanitarian assistance. And not only that, their crisis is slow boiling, so it doesn't draw attention the way that the one in Sudan is drawing today, or should there be an outbreak elsewhere, will draw tomorrow. To just give some perspective in terms of numbers, Yemen is a country of about 31 million people, and upwards of 24 million require some form of humanitarian assistance. That is the majority of the population. And this isn't just humanitarian assistance to make their lives better. It's assistance that they require to live. They really live on that line between life and death inside of the country. And their stories are going untold. There are no good guys in the country when it comes to who is helping the Yemeni people the most. There are impediments both on the Yemeni government side and on the Houthi side, as well as with the international community. The efforts by the humanitarian organizations that are trying to deliver life-saving aid are underfunded, and the funding year by year has gone down. So when we're looking at the country itself, it is in desperate need of emergency humanitarian assistance just to get by day to day, week to week. But over the longer term, the core challenge Yemenis are going to face is that the years of conflict in their country has destroyed the infrastructure, which means that they actually do need longer term development assistance in order to break this cycle that they're currently in.
Just a quick follow-up. The United States has a special envoy to Yemen, does it not?
It does. He was appointed by the president. It was his first big foreign policy move.
And what can you say about his role in pushing this to a more peaceful and stable conclusion? Does he have any leverage in your view?
Special envoy Tim Lenderking has a unique ability to bring different parties together. He has the United States power behind him, but he doesn't have specific leverage over Yemeni actors. And crucially, he doesn't have leverage over the Houthis, who have continued to serve as spoilers in this fight, taking maximalist positions in terms of what they're requiring for a negotiated solution, simply because they can. But what Special Envoy Lenderking has done is really tried to add his support in the various ways that he can to the UN-led effort, which is led by a UN Special Envoy, to help bring Yemeni parties together to determine what each side is looking for peace, and to try to help set those conditions. When you're looking at Special Envoy Lenderking's task, it's certainly not one that many would have signed up for, since it's enormous in terms of what he has in front of him, with a very hard path to follow towards success. But he has served in various positions within the State Department on the Arabian Peninsula for many years. So he has a lot of the relationships that he needs and knowledge of the complexities of the situation to give him the best possible chances of success.
You are listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Catherine Zimmerman, a fellow in counterterrorism at the American Enterprise Institute here in Washington, and we're discussing the outcomes of U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's meetings in Saudi Arabia and with the Gulf Cooperation Council. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voaafrica.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at @Carol_Castiel or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Well, here's a shout out to a Facebook fan, Mpho Ledwaba from South Africa. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com. Or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our terrific guest, analyst Catherine Zimmerman with the American Enterprise Institute. Catherine, let's continue our conversation about Antony Blinken's trip to the Middle East, particularly Saudi Arabia, and meeting with the Gulf Cooperation Council. How much of a factor is Iran in these meetings, notwithstanding the somewhat rapprochement, warmer relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran? I think Iran is generally seen as still a rival, is it not, of the Gulf Arab states? And I was just wondering to what extent it's a big issue with regard to its nuclear capability growing by the day. And of course, that must be a factor in Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's interest in wanting to have a formal U.S. guarantee of Saudi Arabia's security and U.S. assistance in creating a Saudi civilian nuclear infrastructure.
Iran is certainly always in the shadow of these talks, especially for the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia. It's something that's not always discussed openly, but Iran's growing power is influencing decisions. I think the key point with Yemen is there's this idea that the Iranians can somehow rein in the Houthis and help them see the light and accept a solution that would be acceptable to Saudi Arabia. The concern that I continue to have is that the Houthis themselves do not see themselves as subordinates of Iran, and they see themselves as equal partners. So even if Iran were to tell the Houthis what to do, it's not clear that they actually would do it. I think the bigger picture, though, drawing back out of Yemen and into the region is twofold. One, the Arab states, and particularly the Gulf states, do see and question now the American security umbrella. Is it retracting from them? Is the United States going to actually come to their defense and ensure the security and stability of the region as the U.S. continues to reduce commitments, as it continues to build up its investments in other parts of the world, namely in the Indo-Pacific, and also as its principals are very concerned and captivated by the current war in Ukraine and the contest with Russia. Not all puts the Middle East down on the priority list, and certainly the Gulf states know this. It's led to some of the hedging behavior. You mentioned how China's influence has grown in the region. A lot of that has to do with the fact that the Chinese are coming in to take advantage of the fact that they can sell weapons that the United States might not be ready to provide. And there is growing space for the Chinese to operate inside of the Middle East. The same thing is true for Iran. And there are some indications that the Gulf states may be looking to warm their relations with Iran in order to gain some of that security and stability that you referenced, Carol. This idea that if they have closer ties with Iran, it won't lead to an escalation of conflict with themselves, which, as we're looking at the region, there is the potential now with the Israeli Gulf State alliance under the Abraham Accords that there is an anti-Iranian axis present. So some of that is, of course, the Emiratis have actively been meeting with Iranian officials and warming their relations. We just saw the Chinese negotiated deal between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Something that I think has been underreported, at least from what I've been seeing, has been the Emirati decision to pull out of a combined maritime task force that is led by the United States and instead announce that it is joining an Iranian-led task force that includes other Gulf states for the security of the Persian Gulf. It's a big shift in terms of maritime security. What we're looking at here is a very rapid change in dynamics and relationships, all related to regional security and stability, as various actors try to position themselves relative to the various powers that are active in the Gulf region.
That is interesting. Just quickly, this is more of a normative question. What is your opinion of that shift? Do you think that's a good thing in terms of a greater rapprochement or hedging and trying to cooperate like the UAE is with Iran?
There are elements that are quite positive. I think the idea of common security between Israel, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and the other signers of the Abraham Accords certainly breaks down some of the boundaries. It changes fundamentally the Arab-Israeli relations and, of course, has prompted some of the U.S. effort, which Secretary Blinken has referenced in his readout from his meetings, about getting Saudi Arabia and Israel to warm their relations as well. So kind of solving the Israel problem in the Middle East would let that region move beyond the question of Israel and the Palestinians. That, of course, is incredibly complicated and doesn't get resolved even if Israel and Saudi Arabia have full relationships. The question of the Palestinians remain. But I think as we're looking at the warming of relations with Iran, the introduction of China, it makes it very complicated, especially for U.S. interests. The United States looks at the Middle East as a place of core interest because of its energy and also because of its positioning for global trade. There are two of the world's major maritime choke points in the Middle East. one off the coast of Yemen, the Bab el-Mandeb Strait, the other one in Egypt with the Suez Canal. Those are essential for the continuation of global commerce and supply to the United States. Free trade, basic ideas that underpin the liberal world order that benefits the U.S. As that shifts, or should things shift where we may not find as reliable partners in the Middle East, the U.S. may be looking harder for somebody to come to its assistance when there's a world crisis, just because we have pulled back a little bit in terms of managing our own end of that relationship.
All right. Well, speaking of the Abraham Accords and the potential for normalizing relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia, just like Israel did under the Trump administration, between Israel and Morocco, Israel, Bahrain, Israel and the UAE, what are the prospects in your view? News reports indicate that one of Riyadh's conditions for normalizing ties with Israel is developing a civilian nuclear program, although they don't really say that publicly. What do you think is going to happen in that realm? Is there a timeline? Is it just a matter of time that this will take place? There's also political considerations. I imagine President Biden would like to see a relationship, a normalization in the run-up to his re-election campaign.
It's hard to say. The Saudis have stated publicly that they will not abandon the Palestinian people, who, when you look at the reactions to the Abraham Accords, the largest criticism from within the region levied against the states that signed it is that their biggest piece of leverage against Israel for the Palestinians was removed, because it was the diplomatic relationships and the normalization of ties to Israel, which previously had been predicated on resolving the Palestinian issues. Saudi Arabia has said that it would not move from that. But I think the nuclear issue, which has surfaced much more recently in terms of the civilian nuclear program for Saudi Arabia, is interesting, especially as you're watching the Iranian nuclear program advance rapidly. And there is growing concern within the national security community that we're going to see nuclear proliferation in the coming years. The United States, of course, is adamantly against this. It has refused to support Egypt's civilian program, which has caused Egypt to turn to Moscow. And what it seems like to date is that the U.S. is pushing back on Saudi Arabia itself, again, trying to limit the proliferation of nuclear power and capabilities in order to preserve the current balance of power amongst the nuclearized states.
So much more to talk about in the few minutes we have left, Catherine. I just want to mention one sentence that I've read by somebody at the Atlantic Council, an interesting comment by John Fulton. He's a non-resident senior fellow. He said that China would help the Saudis in sectors where the U.S. won't, but he believes that the relationship between Riyadh and Beijing doesn't really have the same depth. And he says he characterizes the U.S.-Saudi relationship as strategic and the China-Saudi relationship as transactional. Would you agree with that characterization?
I agree with that wholeheartedly, and it reflects my own conversations with Saudi officials, but also with other Arab officials who really describe their relations with Beijing as transactional, a tit for tat, the idea of we need this and you need that, and we can craft a deal where we each come out happy. Whereas the strategic partnership with the U.S. is one where Saudi Arabia does look to the United States, even as it's hedging for the regional security and stability. It has a long time relationship with the United States. It understands to some degree the ups and downs of the Washington political cycle, new presidents, new administrations, new political objectives, and has really framed itself as a partner who can be turned to at times of crisis. It accepted and helped during the Afghanistan withdrawal, which happened with very little notice. But I think the message that the kingdom has delivered, particularly to the Biden administration recently, is that even though we do have this very deep partnership, it is a two-way street. And the United States has to hold up its end of the bargain when we're looking at what the Saudis are asking.
Helping solve the outbreak of violence in Sudan is another area, Catherine, where the United States is looking towards Saudi Arabia, the Gulf Arab states, to perhaps make a difference. What role do you think the GCC and Saudi Arabia in particular can play? Some analysts say that they really are the key in getting the sides to stop and hammer out a ceasefire. Would you agree with that? Do they have that kind of leverage with these generals?
They certainly have the relationships and the resource relationships with these generals. And the U.S. has fundamentally stepped back from the conflict and empowered the Saudis and our Gulf partners to solve it. I think it's quite telling that when the U.S. evacuated its personnel from the embassy, that it was the Saudis that stepped up, that it was Americans going to Jeddah, and that really the Saudi state infrastructure mobilized to help support the United States. We didn't have the posture in the region to do what was necessary for our own citizens. So as we're looking at this conflict broadly, it's a reflection on what the U.S. in the region looks like today, but also the ability of the Saudis and other Gulf partners to help shape the decision space for the two Sudanese leaders will be important as we hope that they come to the negotiating table and reach a resolution soon. The Sudan experts might be a little bit more skeptical about how quickly this conflict will resolve. The solution is not going to be some liberal democratic government coming out of this. I think it's unfortunate, as we saw Sudan go through its transition, that the prospects for such a government are really, really small at this point, when there was a bright spark of hope a couple years ago. But I also think that when we look at what the Gulf states are doing in Sudan, we need to recall that they actually are also trying to defend against Iranian influence there too. The old Sudan used to be much closer to Iran and would help facilitate some of the more destabilizing Iranian activities in the region up through Hamas in Gaza as well. And it wasn't until the Yemeni civil war that the Saudis and the Gulf states were literally able to buy Sudanese support for their efforts. And that really flipped Sudan into a client state of the Gulf rather than one of Iran.
And as we close, Catherine, a topic on which you are one of the preeminent experts, and that is combating the Islamic State Network and Al-Qaeda. We know that Secretary Blinken co-hosted a ministerial meeting of the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS. What is the state of play in terms of the Islamic State group in the region? How dangerous is it? Is it on the wane? How effective is this coalition in terms of combating it?
The coalition is struggling with really three key issues with regard to the Islamic State. The first one is preventing the reconstitution of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria of ISIS. And coupled with that, the prevention of the outflow of foreign fighters, either from the various detention camps, Al-Hol being the most prominent of those, which is in Syria, or the radicalization of the next generation of jihadis inside of those camps. There are tens of thousands of people who were affiliated with the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria who are in these detention camps. There is really no true solution yet as to what to do with them. The state of the camps is abysmal, and there is a great fear that the outflow of fighters from Iraq and Syria still could mobilize groups in places like Tunisia or Morocco or elsewhere, and that if these aren't resolved, that you end up with some very hardcore ISIS fighters still inside of Iraq and Syria who could just be the spark for the next return of the group. The second big issue is the expansion of the Islamic State, and I would add Al-Qaeda, inside of West Africa in particular, but really the strengthening of ISIS and Al-Qaeda across the African continent. The De-ISIS coalition is faced with a massive challenge as the state partners in the places where ISIS in particular is active, but also Al-Qaeda, are quite weak. There have been a series of coups. There is internal conflict. There are local insurgencies, all of which provide security challenges that these various governments must address, in addition to the terrorism challenge. And some of the states that had been stable previously, those along the coast of the Gulf of Guinea, for example, are now experiencing growing instability. So this meeting of the Counter-ISIS Coalition welcomed Togo as a new state. Togo is in a very bad neighborhood and seeing a rise in terrorism inside its own borders, driven by the Islamic State. And then, of course, the last challenge, which is Afghanistan. And the fact that there is an ongoing concern that it will return to be a terrorist safe haven. The Islamic State Khorasan inside of Afghanistan is continuing to expand. It is growing. It is developing at least regional attack capabilities and has the intent, at least, to attempt transnational attacks against the West. So that is a massive challenge for the coalition to work on in terms of the Islamic State threat with still quite limited resources. And this idea that many of the core states involved in the coalition are also managing other conflicts, Ukraine being a prime example, that are much closer to home for them.
A daunting array of issues. We're so grateful to you for your insights on all of them. Catherine Zimmerman is a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where she specializes in counterterrorism. Catherine, thank you again for your time and insights. We greatly appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure, Carol.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Do join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.